Welcome to Dispatch Live. It's Tuesday, April 16th, and we've got a great show lined up for all of you tonight. Thank you for tuning in. First off, we'll be joined by David Daoud, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defensive Democracies focused on the Middle East, and Adam James Levin-Arity, multimedia director here at the Dispatcher. Man of Lafroig, as his title states here. We've also got Will Reinhart, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, but more importantly, the author of the newest Dispatch newsletter offering, Techni. And later tonight, we're going to be joined by two members of the Dispatch Politics crew, David Drucker and Charles Hillu, to talk about what is already shaping up to be a very, very crazy week of political news. Couple housekeeping notes off the top before we dive in. Reminder that this show is interactive. We want to hear from you. So if you have questions for me or for any of the panelists, please drop them in the chat, and Victoria and on our team will flag them for us. Also a reminder that Dispatch Live is one of the perks of being a paying Dispatch member. So if you know of other people in your life, friends or family, who will be interested in these kinds of conversations, we hope that you'll send it along and encourage them to sign up. And then lastly, I am at Dispatch HQ right now, if you can't tell. And I know that the custodian generally makes his rounds in about 30 minutes. So there's a chance that we hear some loud vacuuming noises. If you do, that's what that is. And I'll try and get them to stop temporarily. But with that, let's dive in. David, Adam, and Will, thanks for joining us. David, you are in D.C. Adam, you are in Israel, where it is, I believe, a couple minutes after 3 a.m. Right now. So why are you still awake, let alone joining us on Dispatch Live?
Well, I think my clock was destabilized after the attack that you may have heard of happened a few days ago. As promised, we were bombed by, or at least attempted bombed by Iran on the morning of April 14th, and this little footage here that's playing is from the sky of, I believe, Jerusalem. I've tried to collect videos from friends and neighbors that captured the beauty of that night. It was quite a night. The real summary of the experience is that we all knew that some kind of Iranian retaliation is imminent since the attack in Syria by Israel that targeted the compound of an Iranian embassy. And it was just a matter of time and scope. So for about a week, we were all anxious, taking bets on when and how and how much. And I think nobody really expected it to be at the scale that it ended up being, which was around, I think it had the toll is a little less than 400 objects lobbed in our directions, cruise missiles, suicide drones, and ballistics. But I think what we all further didn't expect was just the totality of failure of that attack, which was, I think, just a whole whirlwind on the of emotions. On the night that it happened, we were told at 11 p.m., hey guys, get into your houses, be close to a shelter starting midnight, and anticipate a hit. And then we were told Iran just launched a bunch of drones, and then we're told Iran just launched a bunch of cruise missiles, and they're going to take a couple of hours to arrive, but just be ready for them. So then we're all together zooming each other, just waiting, counting the minutes, and then it happens, and then you start hearing explosions in the air, the loudest explosions I've ever heard, and I've been here since I've been raised here, I've been here from the second intifada, and I've been here when rockets were arriving from Gaza. and this was like nothing we've ever experienced in terms of volume, and literally the volume. But then we learn that between the Israeli technology and the alliance that was forged in order to countervail the attack, we ended up with only a single casualty, which is still tragic, but is absolutely stunning. And I think the mix of all that emotional turbulence and roller coaster is still active in my brain. And this is basically why I'm still up at 3 a.m.
You're up at 3 a.m. pretty regularly, I know, based on when you're sending me ideas for new podcasts and whatnot. This is not exclusive to today, but I do obviously understand that there's a lot going on. I mean, here it happened in D.C. Saturday afternoon. Steve and I were immediately talking. We were making sure that you were okay. I was texting Charlotte, making sure that she was okay, based in Tel Aviv. And I think one of the things that struck me the most was both how calm both of you were. I think in part because this is, you know, not necessarily a daily occurrence, but things like this happen very regularly. And B, because this was so telegraphed and so expected for days, for weeks after an allegedly Israeli strike in Syria. David, could you give listeners a little bit of backstory about what precipitated this? I mean, in the immediate term, obviously, there's decades and decades and decades of conflict here. But what does Iran say that they are retaliating for? And why was it so telegraphed and obvious to folks that this was coming?
Pleasure to be on. And my regards to Charlotte. She's a you know, colleague, and she's been great to be in contact with since I've come back to FTD. Look, so starting on April 1st, the Israelis, we all know it's the Israelis, let's be honest here, conducted an airstrike in Syria, targeting what's been described variously as a Iranian consulate in Damascus, or at least a building attached to it. Although from a legal standpoint, given what was going on there, it really doesn't make a difference. There was an attack that was probably being planned. The main target was a IRGC Quds Force general named Mohammad Reza Zahedi. Mohammad Reza Zahedi is a veteran of the IRGC Quds Force. This is Iranian Islamic Revolution Guard Corps' external arm, which is the arm that is responsible for the IRGC's regional activities. He has been a member of the IRGC since the days of the Iran-Iraq War, so the early 1980s. He was a veteran of that war. He was deployed to Lebanon in 1998, around the time that Qasem Soleimani became the commander of the Quds Force. There's a picture of him that came out after he was killed, Zahedi, and it shows him with Nasrallah, with two former Hezbollah commanders, military commanders that have now been killed. One was Imad Mughniyeh, killed in 2008, Mustafa Badruddin in 2016. And Qasem Soleimani himself, who was killed in 2020. You know, his first tour of duty, according to Hezbollah Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah, started from 1998 and lasted to 2002. And then irregularly, he came back. He came back around 2008, according to Nasrallah, weeks after Hezbollah's commander Imad Mughniyeh was killed. And he stayed there until 2014. So he was there when Hezbollah entered Syria. And then he, after 2014, he returned to Iran. And then he came back again in 2020 after Qasem Soleimani was killed. So this is very irregular. And it's a testament to his role that he played in the Quds Force in general, most likely to the success that he had in helping build up the capabilities of Iran's arms. Its extensions, you know, more commonly called, but inaccurately, its proxies in the region. And according to Nasrallah, this man was responsible for activities in Syria, Lebanon, and the Palestinian territories. So building up Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, kind of the activities that we've seen in the West Bank. I even saw a report, but I have to double check, that he may have also had some role in the planning of the October 7th attack. In any case, his role, you know, as we know, there's a war between Israel and Gaza going on. since October 7th. Hezbollah decided to join that war on October 8th, kind of this war of attrition that we see on Israel's northern border. So doubtlessly, Zahedi had a role, some kind of advisory role, some kind of planning role in this. He wasn't someone who was just having a meeting in a consulate in Damascus. As far as we know, the reports indicate that he was killed in the midst of a meeting with Palestinian Islamic Jihad officials. It would also seem that a Hezbollah member was killed afterwards. So it's likely that whatever the outcome of this meeting would have directly impacted the Israelis negatively in terms of their security, had they been able to go implement whatever decisions they came to. So the Israelis appear to have intercepted that, killed Zahedi, six additional of his IRGC Quds Force colleagues, and a Hezbollah member. Now, Iran had to retaliate. This was a public humiliation for the Iranians. He's not an insignificant target, as we've mentioned. As far as they were considering this, this happened on Iranian soil. So this is kind of a different calculus than what had happened in Syria. The Israelis have been striking in Syria for at least 11 years now. They've killed some Iranians. It's nothing new. But this kind of, this was a different level, both because of the target and where it occurred. They had to do something, both for practical reasons and, more importantly, I think, to shore up their image among their support base. The whole reason for supporting the resistance axis, as it's called across the region, is primarily, again, resistance. So if you look like you can't fight against the hated Zionist enemy, which you're constantly telling people is on the verge of collapse and on the verge of dissolution, and you're telling people, well, Hamas is really winning the war in Gaza, this is a public humiliation. At the same time, you really don't want to get into a fight with the Israelis, because for all the braggadocio, you know the reality. You know that the balance of power is in the Israelis' favor. So you want to telegraph this. And, I was, if it was appropriate to joke, I was kind of joking that Khamenei is sitting in Tehran and praying that Iron Dome and David Sling are as effective as they claim to be. So I think they wanted this to look painful, and it could have been, right? It's hard to kind of play the what-if game, because, as we know, a lot of these projectiles were intercepted by the Israeli Air Force, by the Jordanians, by the United States and the British and other regional partners way before they even entered Israeli airspace. So it's hard to know if this was kind of a just spray and pray and what would have happened and the damage that would have happened afterwards. But, fortunately, it was relatively minimal. We obviously all pray for the recovery of Amin al-Husni, the young 7-year-old girl who was wounded. It may have been, intended to be much worse. It's hard to kind of determine, but it ended up being a lot of noise, light, a lot of noise. And I think the point was what we saw afterwards, with these celebrations in Palestine Square in Tehran and among the other supporters of the resistance axis, who felt that the prime patron was really as strong as it claimed to be and capable of making the hated Zionist enemy hurt.
Back on the United States side of things, one of the quotes that emerged and kind of defined the conversation was Biden reportedly telling Netanyahu to, quote, take the win in a phone call after this attack that you were just describing, David, that there, for all of the bluster, for all of the military might that went into it, one casualty, and in addition to that, a show of force, I think, Israel realizing that they're perhaps not as isolated in the region as many people thought a week ago, with the Jordanian military, US, France, UK, all rising to Israel's defense. Nick had a great newsletter for us yesterday on this point, but there's questions now, obviously, about what Israel's going to do next. It sounds like a decision could be coming within the next 24, 48 hours. What's the latest that we're hearing? And this is kind of a question that we've gotten from a couple people in the chat, Phil Harris, Gary McClellan, and others. What is a retaliation potentially going to look like? And is Israel now in a position where it can try and quote unquote take the win and de-escalate and move on to the next phase?
Look, I think there, at any time that Israel is engaging any faction of the resistance axis or any, you know, or all of them in totality, there's two parallel wars. There's the kinetic war, and there's kind of the war for hearts and minds. And both are equally important in different ways, right? Kind of what you mentioned, this reinvigoration of support. The week before, Israel had found itself in kind of a bit of hot water after the strike that killed the World Central Kitchen volunteers, the humanitarian aid convoy in Gaza. And the Israelis conducted an investigation. We probably all know that the Israelis didn't do it intentionally. Some wires got crossed and these people were tragically killed. If I were the Iranians, I would have let the Israelis kind of stew in that. But again, I think they had to shore up their image. I think when you bring Iran into the equation, though, and Iran doing what it did, it kind of reformulates the international perception of the war that's going on. It seems like we've got the situation we have on our hands is one where there's been a reinvigoration of the legitimacy of Israel's war against Hamas, as perhaps this attack demonstrated to the world, or at least world leaders, that Israel is not just up against Hamas. Israel is up against a power that, you know, it does have ballistic missiles. It didn't tip them with something, you know, non-conventional this time, but perhaps it could in the future. Right? It drove home the threat that the Islamic Republic of Iran poses to the region and to Israel a little bit more. And it's an opportunity for the Israelis, if they play it smart, to have to walk and chew gum at the same time. I don't think the Israelis can remain silent against this attack, because again, this kind of goes to the perception war. And the perception, it's not just about the friend, it's also about the foe. You want to impact the perception that Iran's support base has of Iran. You want to demonstrate, if their whole popularity is based on the idea that they have the initiative all the time, that they have the upper hand, you want to show that Israel can have the last word and make it painful. At the same time, you know, if you're looking at your partners in the West who've really gone to bat for Israel now, right? I think this is the first time in Israel's history, at least that I can recall, where non-Israeli forces intervened on behalf of the Israelis, right? The classical IDF doctrine has always been, you know, fight for ourselves by ourselves. And this is the first time that a foreign force has really, thankfully no one was harmed, but has entered in on side of Israel's defense. It makes Israel feel that it is part of an international coalition that actually helps it in dealing with the war in Gaza, and it helps it counter Iran. You don't want to lose that. This is actually a moment of opportunity. So I think the Israelis need to play this smartly. As to what has been decided, there's conflicting rumors, reports coming out from Israeli media. I saw reports today that, you know, the form of the attack had been decided upon, but the timing had not been decided upon. I think there's supposed to be a third war cabinet meeting that's supposed to happen that hasn't happened. There were reports yesterday that Prime Minister Netanyahu was going to hold security briefings, not just for the head of the opposition, but for all of the heads of the opposition parties, which is irregular. Usually there's a security briefing between the Prime Minister and the head of the opposition. This is a little bit more. To my mind, this recalled the Six-Day War. But again, whatever decision you want to take, you don't want to lose the Americans and you don't want to upset the Americans. You don't want to upset the Europeans who have made it very clear we don't want a regional war. There were reports, I think, on Channel 11 today that Prime Minister Netanyahu had rejected a suggestion to target sensitive sites in Iran, and that also that Defense Minister Gallant and Minister Gantz, who's now a member of the War Cabinet, had suggested that Israel wait at least to form kind of a regional coalition before it engaged in a response. Other ministers, all these remained unnamed, kind of pushed against that. Some were pushing for immediate, some were pushing for delaying. There was polling on the Israeli public, right, where I think a majority want a response against Iran either now or at some point in the near future. And there was a breakdown. I'm forgetting the exact breakdown, but I think it was like something like 39% wanted it in the near future, and 29%, don't quote me on these numbers, wanted it immediately. But there is a desire for a response. And so far, it seems like the Israelis are taking their time to figure out what that's going to be. I think it's going to be something that doesn't escalate the situation, that kind of shows that Israel has the upper hand, but also closes the file and allows Israel to move on to the more immediate and in some ways bigger problem of Rafah.
That's a story that we'll be covering very closely here in the coming days in Morning Dispatch, in with Charlotte's reporting on the ground there in Tel Aviv. Before we move on to our next segment, I want to, Adam, this one's for you. It's from Amy Toddy in the chat, and kind of builds on some of the stuff that David was just talking about. 6 months after October 7th, what is the prevalent feeling of Israelis regarding the military efforts to defeat Hamas in Gaza? And has anything changed in Israeli opinion about it? And I want to expand that a little bit to incorporate this most recent strike from Iran and kind of the Israeli response.
So let's start with the end. Actually, it's a difficult story. So when we're talking about public opinion, it's always hard to evaluate. But there has been a turn, I think, generally among Israelis sweeping majority in support of our actions in Gaza to growing skepticism about the direction and how the war is being handled. I don't think there's been any change in the general support for punishing Hamas. And I don't like using the word eradicating, because I don't know what the government means at this point by using it. But certainly causing it enough damage that it will be difficult for it to rebuild its infrastructure. And I think there's still a lot of support for that. But the recent months have led to more conflict between the parts of Israel that think that the priority should be dismantling Hamas, and those who say that the priority should be reaching a comprehensive deal to get the hostages freed. And we know that every attempt to reach some kind of agreement about the hostages has ended up collapsing, primarily due to Hamas. Recently, they've just turned down a deal to release 40 hostages and returned by saying, no, we're only going to release 20. At this point, after some reporting from the Wall Street Journal, we know that there is a possibility, there's growing anxiety and possibility that Hamas doesn't really have enough access to living hostages to really meet the expectations of the Israeli negotiators. But this sense of uncertainty is just causing more and more anxiety and frustration on the Israeli side with the government, at least for one faction. And there's growing tensions between that faction and the faction that wants more aggressive action against Hamas, which I think people understand might come at the expense of ever being able to reach a serious deal and maybe forfeiting the release of the hostages altogether. That's where we were on April 13th. The moment that Iran attacked, and with the sort of total humiliation, I think, that Iran suffered in response, I think the mood for the first time since October 7th in Israel was collectively joyous. It is kind of crazy to say that, but I think we didn't even play the clip that I wanted. I want to show you that that contrast, and that I think will be the tone to end on. This is a clip. This video and this sound, this terrifying sound of the siren, this was the kind of the background music of that night in Jerusalem. This is right around the corner from where I live, and the visuals and the sounds and you can hear the explosions here. All of it was, like I said, more intense than we've ever experienced. And yet, because of seeing Jordan jumping into the fray, the technological marvel, we felt for the first time since October 7th, powerful. And I think that sense of confidence is going to have an effect on public opinion on how Israel should move forward in waging the war. I think a lot of Israelis do share Nick's suggestion of we should take the W and refocus our efforts elsewhere rather than retaliate to Iran and risk showing dents in our ability and military prowess. But it definitely is causing a shift. So where this shift is going, how this shift is going to play out, well, I have no idea. But my hunch is that people are much more eager for this to be recalibrated into a stronger military strategy towards Hamas, with long term thinking towards Iran, rather than like throwing all our chips into a huge gamble and retaliate forcefully against Iran right now.
That's a great great spot to end here. We're going to continue to follow this story. I wanted to thank David. Thank you for joining us. Really appreciate your insights on this. And Adam, thank you for staying awake. Please stay safe and go to bed. Not to be your mom, but it's way too late.
Yeah, she's in the other room.
And then she should be telling you that.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you guys for hopping on. Will, you are a trooper for I was hoping to get to you and didn't want to jump in and cut them off. But we're now, I guess, a little bit more than a month into your newsletter with the Dispatch. Before we dive into anything in particular, how do you feel like it's going so far? Are you having fun writing for us?
Oh yeah, very much so. Back many moons ago when I was still an undergraduate, I think I actually mentioned this when we first started talking about this newsletter. I actually was the editorial writer for the Daily Illini. So having that kind of like two pieces production was very, very, very common. And it kind of, you know, it feels like old times really, because I was writing those op-eds pretty consistently. So yeah, it's been good. And it's also been allowing me to explore a whole bunch of different topic ideas that I've been wanting to work through. In fact, the last time that I was on here, kind of Kevin Williamson, I know we're going to talk about it here shortly, but Kevin had kind of mentioned or asked this question, you know, is this an issue that the Beltway cares about, or is this an issue that real Americans care about? And I really kind of, you know, this is something I've been thinking about for quite some time, this idea of an illusion by the majority, a majority illusion. But I really, you know, in one of the recent pieces, I kind of work through that idea and work through that notion. So it's those sorts of things that I'm excited about working through, and kind of in the future, I've got a whole bunch of these other things that are coming up. I'm thinking about potentially writing. I don't know if you've been seeing this new. Basically, it is a mouthwash, and people take it, and then they don't have cavities anymore because it replaces all of the microbes in your mouth. And so it's not at all approved by the FDA. So I've been seeing all these people go down to Honduras and, you know, all these kind of crazy Silicon Valley folks. At some point I may talk about that and just kind of think through those sort of kind of big, you know, smaller things, but are still very, very interesting to me, you know, the kind of the bleeding edge. But I guess, you know, that's a long-winded way of saying that this is giving me, I think, the flexibility to talk through a whole bunch of tech topics that are, you know, connected, I think, universally, like they are connected in a way, but aren't naturally connected in the way that I think a lot of people would think about them.
We're enjoying it a ton. I know I certainly am, and I know I've heard from a lot of readers who are very glad that you're with us.
Send me hate mail. I love hate mail, and I've been trying to respond to people who send me responses and, you know, are very kind, and I've gotten a lot of really good feedback, and some people have said, hey, I didn't really agree with you, so I've been trying to do my best to engage in those conversations. And I think that is, you know, the give and take of being in this space and doing tech work.
Yeah, we have a really, really great community of readers that we've built over the years. And I'm not just saying that because they allow us to exist and pay all of our salaries. So I do want to jump into that newsletter that you referenced that you wrote 2 weeks ago, which I hope everybody read, because it's one of the more important things that we've published this year, in my view. And the gist, and I'll ask you to summarize it, but is basically that a small group of very loud, very partisan people are responsible for the vast majority of the online conversation, or what we might call capital D discourse. And I want to read a quote, and Victoria, I think we have one here, but most of what you see online, therefore, is often a loud, small, partisan minority. In turn, this group can misshape an individual's perception of the general public, leading to the misconception that some beliefs are more common than they really are. Production inequality on the internet skews the discourse, making it seem as though the public is far more divided than it actually is. This is one of I think the more optimistic things that we've published this year, but it also has the benefit of being true if survey data is any indication. So what inspired you to write this piece, in addition to Kevin's comment on Dispatch Live a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, no, it sparked me into, I mean, I've been thinking about this for a while, and in part it comes from a whole bunch of different places. And, you know, one of the big drivers of this is actually my mom, interestingly enough, of all people. After 2016, she basically disappeared from the internet. She was actually online pretty early. You know, my family, my dad is kind of a, you know, he's a tech nerd, so he's been online. Our family's been connected to the internet for quite some time. But when 2016 happened, she left pretty dramatically. And she said she just didn't want to be involved in the discourse anymore. And she didn't want to be involved in this because she just thought it wasn't good for her own mental health. And I've noticed a lot of my other friends and family do this as well. You know, they lurk, they watch, but they're not really engaged in a way that you would see, you know, the way that I'm engaged, perhaps you're engaged, right? And I also have noticed this throughout the discourse, is that I try to keep my wits about me, but I do know that people who are more say crazier things online, you know, they get more views, they get more reactions, they get more likes, there is more, you know, you're fanning the flames, but in doing that you there's a lot of benefit as somebody who's a writer. And those slower pieces, those pieces that try to actually think through what's going on, that try to, you know, try to be even-handed and level, like those obviously, or we know that those generally don't do very well. So this piece tries to compile what we've seen throughout the research space. We see this, you know, my previous organization, we actually asked this question: how consistently are you going online? Do you feel like online places are the places to engage in political discourse? It follows along with other political science surveys and Pew data, and then kind of just really a lot of data that we found over the years that very narrow people and very, very, you know, basically a very small percentage, typically about 10% or 15% of a group is the most active, and an even smaller percentage are the ones who drive most of the conversations on Reddit, on Twitter, on even NPR, right? NPR had to shut down its discussion and commentary system because there was a couple hundred folks who were just spamming it all of the time, which I actually find that was among the most interesting of the examples. But we see this a lot within the internet. It's just, that is it's a very consistent theme, and it's something that if you look for it, you're going to find it.
My prediction came to pass. The custodian is here with the vacuum, so I do apologize if it's hard to hear me right now. I'll do my best. But I think that the NPR example that you provided in particular was really fascinating, and NPR is in the news for a whole bunch of other reasons this week. probably somewhat related in a way, but the idea that what was the stat? It was something like 2% or no, 2,600 commenters accounted for 90% of
something like comments. And it was those 2,600 of the entire group, which made it incredibly toxic. And that's the other part of this that I think is, which I wish, you know, I hope that came through in my piece, which is that there's a very small minority of people who are producing all the toxic content as well. So within Reddit, it's very, very small. It's like 1 or 2%. But they are the ones who drive the negativity online. And that also has this effect, which is that people think the online spaces are a lot more negative than they actually truly are. And that actually drives moderates out. And so we've seen moderates over time not be a part of the discourses on Twitter and on Facebook, and I don't know so much on TikTok. TikTok's a kind of a different beast altogether. But you know, we see this thing is that people perceive these spaces as being radical one way or the other. And I think that there's a lot of, I would give that interpretation pretty wide latitude. I think that, you know, it's easy to see bad content anywhere, and it really drives people away and has a kind of a, you know, a bad effect on the discourse online. And it really drives, I think, this perception that things are just different than they truly are.
I've heard it anecdotally quite a bit in conversations with Dispatch members, with friends and family, that they, in one of the reasons that they read us is because they hate existing so much on elsewhere on the internet, where it's a lot nastier and a lot meaner. And but even us, we know internally that, you know, only somewhere between 10% and 15% of our readers ever use the comment section there, and that's a self-selecting group as well, a much more delightful and kind group, as I think you've probably picked up on already. But still, it's not a representative sample. I know you're not a campaigns guy. We have the campaigns guys joining relatively shortly, but. What do you think the effect of this kind of phenomenon is on our national politics, where, you know, if a politician's tweeting something and they get a great response, if it's super inflammatory and or get dunked on by an influencer, if it's not what the base is craving, do you think that politicians are misreading what their voters actually want?
Yeah, no, I think that is actually there is a misread of what that politics looks like, or what politics should be. You know, one of the things that I cited within there was this New York Times Siena poll, which I think is actually very indicative of all of this. It really asked about democracy, and, you know, this is really quickly, you know, this is soon after all the January 6th hearings were happening, and it was really within that sort of milieu I believe it was in late 2022. And you did see a concern, and people were concerned about generally everything kind of related to the hearings at the time. But much more broadly, you have this bigger concern of corruption within democracy. So the point being is that it can lead a kind of a political conversation. And I guess what I would say is that this is a give and take, right? I don't want to say there's a balance, but some things are brought to the attention that definitely need to be brought to the attention, because there is a certain subset and certain group that is clearly bringing these issues to the forefront. But at the same time, it has this effect of not necessarily placing everything on an even playing field, and that some of these issues, like I said, primarily, you know, concerns about corruption when it relates to democracy seem to not be yet talked about as much as this broader concern. I mean, and I think it's rightly there about what's happening with democracy. So just, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm trying to help folks rebalance what is going on and say that, yes, these things are concerning, not to say that political issues that are driving campaigns are necessarily, I mean, they definitely drive individuals. They drive people to get out to vote. They drive campaign dollars. And that is part of the political process. But that when it comes to legislating, when it comes to policy, I guess that would be my, you know, I'm a policy wonk at the end of the day. I've got friends who work in the campaign side of things, but when it comes to policy, I think that I think you do need to take a bit of a different viewpoint. Right. And I would say this really kind of exists broadly, that, and I don't feel like this is a detriment to the political system, right? To get elected is a certain kind of group, and then when you get into office and the certain things you're actually able to do and certain kinds of policy that you're actually able to pass, given your coalitions, I think those can be and oftentimes are going to be two different things. I don't think it's two-faced, as some people would say, but it's just part of the political process that these two things drive. You know, politics isn't policy, and I think we just need to be very clear that those two things are happening at the same time.
We need to create the echo chamber feedback loop where politicians need to know they should repeal the Jones Act. If they'll just read the comments section on Scott Lincecum's newsletter every Wednesday, they'll get that done real quick.
I don't have to go down that route. I get to deal with the simpler topics of privacy laws and TikTok, which everyone loves me for anyway. So, yeah.
At some point, we're running short on time. At some point, I would love to talk with you online or offline about a piece we ran today about a national, a potential national digital ID and what that could look like from a privacy perspective, from a, you know, the ability to actually enforce some of these laws that we're starting to see come down the pike, like in Florida on the social media ban, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. How do you know if somebody's 14 or not?
Yeah, we should talk about that. I was actually pretty involved with the previously with this, with the efforts in Utah. My previous organization is actually based in Utah, so we were going down and having conversations with those. That's almost 2 years ago now that was happening. So I would love to, let me know, I can be helpful on that, because there's a lot to parse out. And the court cases that are coming down right now are going to be incredibly determinative of all of that. And the big ones that are going through right now with Florida, Florida and Texas. And then, you know, there was I did a bit of a preview, I think, on the very, very first essay or the very first newsletter that I put together on those court cases. But, you know, those are going to be resolved pretty quickly. They'll be resolved later this year, later this session. So, you know, that will be something that we're going to be talking about. You know, probably by October is my expectation. I think it's September, October. We'll have some better clarity from the Supreme Court on exactly what that means. So it is, there's sure to be more action in that space.
All the more reason we're glad that you're with us. And we hope that everybody sign up for Techne. Give a preview. What's this week's edition going to be on?
So this week is going to be on privacy and the new privacy law, the new privacy bill. It is bipartisan, coming out of the Senate on one side of the committee on the Senate and also the House, and just what's been going on there and the politics as I've been really paying attention to them for the last 10 years on privacy. So there's a lot that's happening at the states and then at the federal level. I think that there's this interesting back and forth that's happening, obviously, with the states. States are doing a lot and trying to just lay some of that out and lay out what's likely to happen. And my suspicion that probably we're not going to get that law passed this time around with this session, given everything else that's coming out.
Look forward to reading it tomorrow. So, yeah. And everybody else can read it the day after that. So,
I need to spend a little bit of time tonight and finish that up. So, yeah, thanks.
Then we better get you off Dispatch Live so you can do that.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I think, I'm not doing a one man show. I was nervous there for a second. I don't have that much material. Drucker, Charles, thank you very much for joining us. Sorry, we're running a little bit behind. Had two great conversations that didn't want to wrap up just yet. But how's your guys' night going?
Hey, man, we're on Dispatch Live.
What more could you ask?
You said exactly what I was going to say, David. I'm left speechless because of that. So thank you.
See, the Dispatch politics team, we're like, it's one brain.
Exactly.
You guys are firing on all. I saw the messages earlier. You guys already have tomorrow's newsletter locked and loaded. And
don't get used to it. It's just we had an off week.
Well, Drucker, speaking of off weeks, you just got back from Michigan on a reporting trip, a trip that was made possible by viewers like you guys at home. I've always wanted to use that PBS line, but. Could you give folks a readout of what you were doing and maybe a sneak peek of the piece that you're working on?
Yeah, sure. And I think you deserve a hat tip because it's a trip that we discussed actually several months ago, and it was sort of interrupted by the Republican primaries, you know, heating up for a brief moment. So you and I both wanted me to get out to Michigan for quite some time. Finally, found some time to do so for us. And you know, the question I've been trying to get at. Number one, given that Michigan is a battleground state and a very important one, is what's the state of play out there for real? Because you don't really know what you think you know by looking at a poll sitting at a desk in Washington or anywhere else. So I wanted to get out there and talk to people. And I wanted to do it in person as much as possible, because even phone calls, which we live on, and emails, but it's not the same kind of conversation that you have in person with somebody. So I spent some time in Lansing and I spent some time in suburban Detroit, and I'm trying to get at exactly what is going on, in particular with President Joe Biden, as he runs for re-election in Michigan, just because it doesn't necessarily seem, and this was sort of bolstered by the conversations I had, that much has changed about Donald Trump. In other words, voters aren't necessarily assessing him differently, other than maybe not feeling as angst-ridden about him as they were in the middle of his presidency. It's been a few years since he was in office, and so some of the exhaustion, some of the things that upset them about him receded in their brain a little, and they're remembering some of the good things. But what I learned by talking to Democrats and Republicans is that largely what's been going on is, at least for now, a reassessment of President Joe Biden. Is he who I thought he was going to be? Am I happy with his leadership? I wish we didn't have this rematch. I wish Donald Trump wasn't the alternative. But if he is the only alternative, maybe I'm going to give him a look. You know, inflation may sound simple to say this. Inflation is a big deal because it is everywhere. But in Michigan, what people were telling me is, look, everybody's got jobs. Manufacturing is doing very well, and people have a paycheck. It's just that it's not going far enough for what they need. And of course, this is a development that has happened under President Biden. And if it happens under a presidency, then you're going to get the blame, even if you don't deserve it. I'm not saying he doesn't deserve it, but that's just the way this goes. And so they're looking to him to do something about it. What I found really fascinating is nobody really would volunteer much about Biden's age. And I would get to the end of these conversations and I'd say, you know, the thing you didn't mention is how old Joe Biden is and how that is contributing to his political challenge. And they'd say, oh yeah, that too. And the feeling was it's baked in. It's just not something you discuss because it's just there. It reminded me in 2018 when I was traveling the country for my previous employer covering the midterm elections. And I'd say, you know, Democratic candidates aren't talking much about Trump's, you know, provocative behavior, his rhetoric, or the Russia investigation. And what Democratic operatives were telling me at the time is, you know, it's just kind of baked in. So we're focused on healthcare and all these other bread and butter issues because everybody already knows about that. And we know that that helps us. So that was interesting. Finally, what I'll say, you know, it's the big question everybody asks is, what about Israel's war in Gaza and how's that impacting what is a particularly robust Arab American community? A lot of newer immigrants, particularly from the Palestinian territories, live in Dearborn, Michigan, but there's a robust Arab American community that Charles Hillou, my colleague here, could speak to more eloquently than I could. But I was asking those questions. How does that impact this race? And you'll have to read my piece to find out what I was told. I heard some things that I didn't necessarily expect to hear. Some I did, but some I did not, about how the president's handling of struck by Hamas is impacting both the Jewish vote and the Arab American vote. But I'll leave that for the piece, which we should have to you early next week.
That is what we call in the biz a teaser, masterfully executed. Everybody's going to have to click through next week. We'll have that on the site. Charles, David mentioned you are a native Michigander. That's the correct term, right?
That's correct.
Illinoisan. I don't want to butcher that. Does his reporting kind of match with your experience being back home? I know you were home recently for Easter. Kind of what is the vibe on the ground in the state?
I would say that the vibe on the ground is essentially that a lot of people in sort of the national media like us, I feel like there is sort of this tendency to portray Michigan as bluer than it actually is. Because remember that it wasn't until 2018 that Governor Whitmer was elected. And before that, we had a Republican governor. And it actually wasn't until, I believe, 2022 when Democrats controlled practically, you know, actually the entire legislature. So Michigan is still a purple state despite the results of the 2022 election. So I think it's important to remember that it is a moderate state and it's not a California or a New York type of state.
Monday's edition of Dispatch Politics led with this. We're probably going to have a lot more coverage of it in the coming days. Mike Johnson's in a very, very perilous position here as he, I guess, what, five months into his speakership. That's if Kevin McCarthy is the new watermark, you don't want to get ousted before he did, which I think was 9 months. Made a trip down to Mar-a-Lago on Monday and got the fairly strong backing of Donald Trump there. They rolled out a plan to vote on legislation that would prohibit non-citizens from voting, which is something that's already prohibited. But Mike Johnson's facing a potential motion to vacate, and the cries are growing in the House. Drucker, what are you watching for the next couple days to see whether this actually turns into something that possibly gives Johnson the boot, or if this is just kind of a, you know, get through this moment, ride out the rest of the election, we'll have this fight later?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I want to be careful because these things can be unpredictable, especially over the past couple of years. What I found interesting is that the Iran's strike on Israel, though repelled almost virtually 100%, seems to have, you know, jogged House Republicans out of their stupor, right? So Speaker Johnson had said that after the Easter recess that Congress was on, that they were going to come back, and he had promised the Republican members of us, you know, he'd promised his conference, because there's still at least half of his conference that favors aid to Ukraine, that one way or the other, we're going to have a vote on this. And they were still trying to figure out what to do. And it sort of was being put off and put off and put off. All of a sudden, the urgency for aid to Israel, which has also been delayed and delayed in part by House Republican shenanigans, in part by then later Democratic opposition, not full, but in part, had delayed that. And you have this Senate bill sitting in the House, which was the combined Asia Pacific, Israel and Ukraine aid bill. And it had just been languishing there. And in the last couple of days, the speaker decided on a plan that was going to give everybody separate votes. So you could vote yes on Israel and no on Ukraine and yes on Taiwan, or no, you know, or any number of combinations there. But then to ensure that it doesn't get bogged down in the Senate, after everybody gets their separate vote, there's a legislative device that packages it all together and sends it to the Senate as one vote. So the Senate essentially gets its package just slightly abridged. And the Senate is open to it, and President Biden is open to it. And Speaker Johnson today basically told Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie to take a hike. He's not resigning. He's not afraid. And he's going to move forward with this. And the upshot is, I do not think, per my sources today, that House Republicans, that a majority, that the vast number of them have any appetite to revisit the dysfunction that they went through when the single vote required to get rid of a speaker was used against Kevin McCarthy. And Democrats, as long as they get the substantive national security bill, military aid bill that they want, that takes care of Ukraine, which the vast majority of Democrats support, and I think a majority of the Democratic caucus does support Israel aid, and then I think everybody supports the Asia Pacific tranche just about, because it's really to address China. I think that they will make sure one way or the other that if Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie pull the trigger on a motion to vacate, that Speaker Johnson can't be ousted. And there are games you can play with this, because if you have enough members in these votes that vote present, or if everybody votes together to table the motion, then it doesn't even come up. And you can then do these things without technically casting a vote for Speaker Johnson if you're a Democrat. But there are a number of Democrats signaling, hey, this might even be a good vote for me, let alone I might do it. So I don't think this is going to happen. There could always be a hiccup between now and Friday evening when the main votes are supposed to occur. They've got to come out with legislative text and language. You got to get a bunch of people to agree on things that don't always agree. It's contentious, but I think Speaker Johnson is otherwise safe, at least through the end of this Congress.
Charles, you just got your official dispatch press pass couple days ago, you and Mike headed down to the Capitol. You're on standby to potentially go up there if news breaks and we need some coverage. What are some questions that you're curious about? What if you do go up there tomorrow, on Thursday? What are the questions that you're most interested in asking these lawmakers?
Well, I'm especially interested in the sort of, David alluded to it, is the question of whether Democrats are going to save Speaker Johnson. There have been a couple today. Tom Suozzi, actually Monday, he wrote this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, very strongly worded op-ed, saying that Democrats should save Speaker Johnson, should support Speaker Johnson if he faces a motion to vacate from Marjorie Taylor Greene because of him bringing Ukraine aid to the floor. And then also Jared Moskowitz, he used the analogy of essentially saying that Thomas Massie wants to set the world on fire and I'm not going to stand by while I have a bucket, was basically what he tweeted out today. So I'm especially interested if there are more Democrats like that, whether it's just going to be those two. And also I'm especially interested in members who voted to oust Speaker McCarthy back in the fall. Are they swayed? You know, are they tired of the dysfunction? Do they regret their choice? Do they think it was the right choice? I'm especially interested to see what they have to say.
It was earlier today, there was kind of a moment where you could tell some sort of email went out or some sort of message, because Republican after Republican were all tweeting out, I support Mike Johnson because blah, XYZ, or Mike Johnson is the bold, courageous leader we need because of XYZ. So it definitely seems like they're a little bit more organized than Kevin McCarthy and his team were back in the fall. But more importantly, I think that these lawmakers just don't want to go through those grueling 3.5 weeks again, which works for us, because I don't think we necessarily want to go through with it either. A lot of very late nights, a lot of unpredictable votes and all of that over more or less nothing in the grand scheme of things. So with that, it is 9 o'clock. We can now start our full hour wall-to-wall coverage of what color tie Donald Trump was wearing at his trial today, whether or not he fell asleep, all of the all of that. No, we are going to leave that for the collision. Thank you everybody for tuning in. Thank you, David. Thank you, Charles, for joining us. I've got to get home and catch a 9:40 Cubs game. They got to stop playing on the West Coast. I'm very tired. So thank you everybody for tuning in.
Good night.